You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 24th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Bonan Vesperon.
What was that?
Esperanto.
Esperanto.
The universal language. The language everybody is supposed to know in a perfect
the language of Shatner.
Sort of word.
Shatner speaks Esperanto?
Yes.
He does. He was in a,
I don't know where I got that from, but I know that.
Because he, there was a movie made in 65 starring Shatner, and it was, the language was entirely Esperanto. So
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A whole movie.
A whole
movie. How come
movie?
I knew something about William Shatner that you didn't know?
Because it's irrelevant to Star Trek.
Surely I get a point.
Oh, absolutely, Rebecca. Your nerdiness has definitely increased.
No doubt.
How many people, I wonder, actually speak that language?
Upwards of 2 million
just
people.
Just William Shatner.
2 million?
2 million worldwide.
Yeah, but is it like always their second language? Or?
Yes.
Well, yeah. Yeah, there's...
Oh, my God.
There's one poor kid in Brooklyn being raised on entirely Esperanto.
Right. Yes.
That's his native language.
There's only 3 web pages written in Esperanto, too.
Unless you come from Esperanta, or wherever they speak it.
A woman who speaks one language and a man who speaks a totally different language can meet and hook up by sharing their second language, Esperanto, and that has happened. And there are documented cases of that happening.
Sure. That could also happen with any other second language that you have in common.
Try learning Chinese. You'll expand your...
Yeah. I once had a professor of mine who was extolling the virtues of speaking Latin relate that same story, that he was in some foreign country and he was able to converse with another scholar because they both spoke Latin, even though they didn't share any other language in common. He was very impressed with himself.
Just learn the language, the place you're going. Oh,
well, easier said than done.
So when you like stumble upon someone that speaks a language that you have in common, like let's say you're on vacation and you're in Italy and you're like an Italian buff and you're like, oh, I want to speak Italian. Like, what do you say to them? Are you like, how's the weather?
What?
Right? Like, what do you say to them?
When you just to check out the language? I don't know. You make small talk.
You make small talk, just like you would say something in English.
Speaking of Italian, I was in the airport yesterday having dinner. And like sitting right next to me with these 3 Italian guys, and they were speaking, you know, in native
Esperanto.
Italian. No, they were speaking Italian, and it was. I just sat there for like a half an hour, just listening to these guys talk in Italian. It was awesome.
You picked up a few words here.
I don't know. It was just the there was like this one older guy who was like telling some kind of funny story to the other 2 guys. It was obvious to pick that up, and he was just his language was so expressive and musical. And flamboyant, and it was just like listening to music, just listening to this guy tell this story in Italian. It was awesome.
That's funny, Steve. I studied it for a few years in college, and I loved it. Like you said, it's very musical. I remember there was like something like 7 or 8 different ways to say the. I mean, everything – they try to make everything – every word agree as much as possible, and it flows so beautifully. It makes me think what they must hear when they hear English. It must seem like such a choppy, disjointed language. Like
aren't you lucky? Because there's actually a YouTube video of, I think, an Italian person singing in what sounds like English but isn't English.
It's how he perceives English.
I looked it up, and it's by an Italian composer named Adriano Celentano for an Italian TV show that I'm not sure when it was done, but it looks by the clothes people are wearing to be like the 70s, I guess. And it's amazing.
In the cold maze, say one prison calling us and I choose all right.
It's gibberish, but that's what English sounds like to foreigners.
I thought it sounded pretty cool.
Yeah. It's an awesome song. It's really well done. So I bet you never thought you'd get that specific of an answer to your question, did you, Bob?
I guess not. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
Still, though, it's hard to replicate how they feel about it.
You know, oh, come on.
Watch the
come
video.
On, Bob.
No, I mean, no, it's really cool, but I mean, it sounds like English to us, but to them, the cool thing is how they perceive it, which is something we can't really ever know because we're just, you know, our language is just embedded in our brain.
Yeah, but
we can't get outside listening, that box.
Listening to that song actually does help, you know, because you can hear the places you can hear how it really does sound like English, but knowing that it's gibberish allows you to more easily identify the aspects about it that make it sound like English.
But what you don't pick up on, what Bob is saying, like when I was hearing that guy speaking in Italian, there's a certain personality that goes along with the language.
Don't you think that that's conveyed in the song? It's like, to me, when I listen to the song, it's like, oh, okay, I get it.
It gives you a little window. I don't think it gives you you could really
like a bravado and a very, a loudness and a directness. I don't know. I mean, to me, it does make it actually really clear.
It's tough to really, to fully, fully appreciate it. I mean, it helps, but to really appreciate it, I think, is just something that was beyond, you know, anybody that.
Not have way, I guess.
Not have way. yeah.
So is the point second languages will always be second languages? And
if you learn them after 4 years old.
Yeah.
After, suck it up. And
there's a window of language development up until you're about four, up to that time, whatever language you learn is like a primary language. It gets encoded in your language cortex. After 4 years old, that window closes. Right. And if you learn a language after that age, then the underlying, anatomy of it is different. And it's by definition a secondary language.
Each language has these units of sound, the tiniest units of sound called phonemes. And the first 4 years of your life, your brain pretty much wraps itself around the phonemes that it hears.
Well, it slots it. It's like, all right, so it's like you have 100 phoneme slots. And for the rest of your life, when you hear speech, when you hear language, you will slot
into one of them, essentially.
Into one of them. Even though there might be five different sounds that all sound similar but distinct in another language,
right.
Your brain will just slot them all into the same phoneme so you can't hear the difference.
Is there an evolutionary advantage to that?
No, it's just the way our brain develops. Yeah. It's just the way it works.
Right.
So,
Bob, do they have to comprehend the thing that they're hearing, or it's really just the vocalization that they need to hear?
Well, there are different components to it, right? So, like, you also learn different syntax up until that age, a different part of your language cortex, and then you think in that syntax, too. So, if you just exposed people to the phonemes, then they would hear them. They would learn, you know, their brain would encode them. But if you don't expose them to the other aspects of the language, they won't learn. You know, they won't encode those other aspects of the language. Well, Evan, tell us about this massive battery in Alaska.
Yeah, and the reason we're talking about it is because on August 27th, 2003... the world's largest battery was connected, brought online to provide emergency power to Fairbanks, Alaska, which is the second largest city in Alaska. Do we have any listeners in Fairbanks? I don't know.
Probably. Let us know.
Yeah, so assuming your power doesn't go out. But the point, and why? So the reason is why. Well, because Fairbanks is in a very extreme environment, and they don't have power lines between Alaska and the rest of the United States. So they're really kind of their own power source unto themselves. They're not on the same grid that the rest of the lower 48 are. And with these tough environmental conditions, you get blackouts a couple times during either the course of a year or over 2 years. And you need something to keep you online if these blackouts occur so that they can kick in their diesel generator power. You need something in between the gap, though, something to fill the gap. And that's what this battery essentially does. It gives you 7 minutes of time in which about half of the town will be able to kick on those backup generators. And it's actually an important thing when you think about it because those winter temperatures can drop it near minus 51 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, but I was reading that. It's like, it's how impressive and big and massive the battery is, and then it said, "Yeah, and it can keep the power going for 7 minutes." I'm like, seven yes. minutes? That's what we get from the biggest battery in the world? 7 minutes for 12?
I was disappointed to hear that too. I was hoping that it was going to be like, you know, a half a day or something. Yeah, that would be cool. But 7 minutes basically only allows them to go and kick on the diesel generators.
Exactly.
Like, anything else beyond that, if there was like a real emergency where the power was going to be out for hours or days, like, this thing won't do anything.
You know, things can freeze up pretty quick, though, over the course of those minutes, right? At those temperatures, you could be in big trouble.
Yeah. Like, you have to plug in your car in places like that, yeah. I've heard.
So the oil doesn't freeze. It keeps the block warm, just above freezing.
Is it for the oil, or is it for – I thought it was for, like, the – I don't know, spark plugs? What's in a car? I don't know what's in a car.
Well, there's a steering wheel, and they have carpet in some of them.
Squirrel.
There are mirrors that you could look in.
Okay. Mr. Fusion.
Everybody shut up. Yeah, actually, I think I know more about Time Machine DeLoreans than any car I could ever actually purchase.
But, Evan, so when I do a web search on the world's largest battery, it gets me to an article that says that in 2012 in Texas, they're going to bring online what will then be the world's largest battery at a wind farm as a way of storing, I guess, and buffering the energy from the wind farm.
It'll give you 8 minutes of energy.
Well, this is the thing. We need massive battery systems in order to buffer energy from inconsistent sources like wind or sun, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest limitation. Right. It's the biggest limit. Like, if you're going to have a solar array, you only get electricity when the sun is shining, and you don't get it when the sun's not shining, which is actually when people use most of their electricity. So how you need to store it for later use. That's still a big barrier to
the hurdle.
Have your solar array in orbit around the Earth.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Or on the moon.
Yeah, well, we always talk about batteries, and it's definitely one of the slower crawls of technology that we have in our society.
Yeah, yeah. So did you guys feel that earthquake yesterday?
Oh, boy.
I was driving in the car, so I couldn't detect it from normal driving vibrations.
I didn't feel anything.
I felt it, and Steve felt it.
I don't think it made it up to Western New York.
It made it farther than that.
Steve, you were in D.C., so you actually felt it pretty significantly, huh?
I was in Virginia.
Wait, let me go over my lame experience first. Then we'll scale up to your cool experience. How's that?
Wow.
If you think my experience was cool, but go ahead.
Well, listen to mine then. I was at work, and I felt this subtle shaking. Very subtle. I thought about it for about 3 seconds, and I thought, oh, you know, every now and then somebody in your building would be moving like a rolling something really heavy, or moving a heavy mass, or just people walking together nearby would kind of sway like that area of the building a little bit. You could just feel a little bit of shake, or a big truck rumbling by could like make a little vibration. And I felt it, and I thought about it for a second, like, oh, okay, no big deal. And then, but then a half hour later, everybody's talking about this earthquake that hit the East Coast. And I was like, holy crap, I just felt my second earthquake in my whole life. And I was very excited about that subtle shaking. So can you beat that, Steve?
Well, before we talk about that, I have been talking to people, you know, in Connecticut, which is pretty far north of where the epicenter was in Virginia. And some people felt it, some people didn't. And you guys tell me if you've noticed this as well, that some people said that if you were like high up in a building, you were much more likely to feel it because the shaking would be amplified.
Yes.
Like if you were at the 10th floor of a building, you would be shaking significantly. But if you were just on the ground or in a house, you might not have noticed it.
Those are the reports.
I can verify that. I was on the second floor, and it was very
more
subtle.
Anecdote from Bob.
Most people didn't feel anything. I had two friends on the third floor who said it was fairly dramatic. But then again, there was somebody else on the third floor who didn't feel anything either. So it probably depends on the structural nature of the building and everything.
My friend was on the 14th floor in an apartment building, and she said the building was swaying back and forth significantly.
Whoa. Yeah. Cool.
So this was, you know, August 23rd, the biggest earthquake on the East Coast of the United States in over 100 years. I think it's the third biggest ever recorded.
It's a 5.9 magnitude.
Yeah, I think the final designation was 5.8, whatever. But it was,
I've read both.
Did you guys see that picture of the devastation of the
yeah
the East Coast?
I loved it.
The earthquake, and it shows a picture of four lawn chairs, and one of them is tipped over.
No, that's awesome. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Actually, my favorite was a follow-up picture that showed George Bush kicking one over, and it said 823 was an inside job.
Oh my God. So, well, luckily, I mean, we're laughing about it. Luckily, there was no major damage. There were no reported deaths or major injuries. There was damage. There was some, you know, scattered damage to homes and commercial buildings. And I think there was even some falling masonry at the Washington's National Cathedral. I saw a picture. One of these spires on the left side was off. And the after effects were, you know, so, you know, not insignificant in terms of precautionary shutdowns of 10 nuclear power plants throughout the East Coast. So, I mean, it was, you know, people are laughing at, you know, the 5.8 magnitude earthquake. I mean, it's really, really kind of lame compared to some of the big ones that we hear about. But there's also some very interesting aspects to the earthquake as well. Do you guys want to hear it?
Well, can I tell my story first?
Oh yeah. See, now would
be a good time before we segue into that.
Take a drink.
So I happened to be in Virginia yesterday when the earthquake struck. Unfortunately, this is my first earthquake ever, and of course I'm completely indisposed when it hits.
You mean like on the toilet? Or?
Let's just say I'm glad I didn't have to immediately evacuate the building because I was already in the process of evacuating something else. Yeah.
Oh my God! I thought you were kidding.
So, no. Steve, you were having like an earth-shaking moment in the bathroom, and the earth shook.
I'm sitting in there all by myself, you know.
Because normally at home you're sitting there with your whole family, right?
Well, yeah. And the you hear that dull rumbling sound, and my first sort of subconscious thought was that, you know, it sounded like if somebody's wheeling one of those big giant plastic carts down the hallway, and it like makes like every 5 minutes when we were interviewing at TAM that would happen. Yeah. I thought something like that was happening, but then it just kept getting bigger and bigger. I'm like, and
it turns out this guy was wheeling a 20-foot garbage can down a hallway.
Yeah, right. The ground was shaking. Like, all right, this is not. Then it had my full attention. Like,
Steve's like, this is like no other shit I've ever taken.
Good thing I'm on this toilet.
Then the weird thing is that I could hear all the walls, the entire structure of the building around me, creaking and moving and shaking. You know, and then I realized that this was whatever was happening. It was something big and bad. I think it was probably an earthquake. I still wasn't sure, you know, because it could have been a bomb going off. So who knows? It was something like that, you know. But I started to become concerned for the structural integrity of the building that it was in, because I've never heard the entire building sort of shifting and moving around me like that before.
You've never been in a haunted house then, Steve,
or the Shake Shack.
Yeah, the Shake Shack. and then it was they actually did like for the first 5 or 10 minutes, nobody knew what to do. Because it's Virginia and nobody knows what to do with an earthquake, you know. There was no protocol.
Look up a manual.
Yeah, but then eventually said they decided to evacuate the building in case there were aftershocks, and so that was the big inconvenience of the earthquake was just the precautionary reaction to it, just shutting everything down and evacuating buildings and sending people home, even though there was no actual damage of significance. But that was it.
So,
that was my
so
first
Steve, were
earthquake.
people running out of the building screaming?
They weren't screaming. They were sort of briskly walking.
So where do they go? What's the instinct? Like you just want to go to high ground or?
Well, they were just hanging out just outside the building, you know.
Kind of get away from things that could
fall on. No one was really panicking because it was over and nothing. The building was totally fine.
Yeah, I think it lasted 30 seconds.
45 seconds.
Wow. It seemed longer.
It was apparently long for an earthquake. But Bob, you were going to tell us why this earthquake was so long and widespread.
Yeah, you would think that such a moderate earthquake with such little damage wouldn't be felt very far because I mean even bigger earthquakes on the West Coast don't seem to propagate that far. The key though is first I'll tell you how widespread it was. I mean I've heard of people reporting it from Georgia all the way to Toronto, Canada. So that's
really?
That just seems immense. It almost unbelievable. But I did verify that on a bunch of different websites. So it turns out
says it's true.
Yes. When you see a consensus like that from good news sites, then it's like,
true. It's Nature News says that's true as well. That's the article.
Nature says it.
Well, they're a pretty credible source.
There you go. Credibility. It turns out that there's actually, I figured maybe there'd be one good reason. There's actually, I counted four good reasons why it would propagate so far. And the first one was described by Thomas Jordan, who's the director of the Southern California Earthquake Center. He was saying that it has to do with the lithosphere of the Earth, which is the outer rocky shell. It's actually cooler on the East Coast. It makes sense. I didn't really know that, but it's the lithosphere of the Earth. Of the East Coast is actually cooler than the West Coast, which you know makes it harder and denser and more solidified and stiffer. So it's kind of like a ringing of a metal bell. It really propagates that energy really well. He's quoted here saying that when something shakes, it's like hitting a bar of steel. It rings pretty well. Whereas on the West Coast, the rocks are higher temperature and is more like hitting something quite a bit softer. So that's one of the most primary reasons why it traveled so far. But Lucy Jones from the United States Geological Survey attributes it to something a little bit different. She said that one of the reasons, is the fact that the crust of the West Coast is all broken up. And so you can imagine if the crust is all broken up because of all the active faults that are there, it's much less efficient at transmitting energy. And that makes a lot of sense. And we do have faults here on the East Coast, but they're very old. They're ancient. They were active like hundreds of millions of years ago. So it's a much more unified, solid, cooler crust. So it's much more efficient at propagating. So another good reason was this one was new. This one didn't see this one coming. It was the shallowness of the epicenter of this quake. Apparently, in Virginia at least, the seismic zone is very, very deep. It's many miles underground, and so by the time an earthquake that happens propagates to the surface, people don't feel anything. I mean, instrumentation could detect it, but people wouldn't feel anything. This quake in Virginia was 3.7 miles underground, which is very, very shallow for an earthquake. So you've got this kind of undiluted energy coming right from under the surface of the Earth. And then the final reason why it traveled far is that the Virginia seismic zone is connected to lots of different faults and fault lines, which are different things, by the way. I didn't know that either. But so because it's connected to this network of faults and fault lines, it was another way, another avenue for this energy to be efficiently propagated throughout the country and into even other countries. Quite an interesting earthquake from something that seems so minor, 5.8 seems so trivial, but some really cool science even in trivial things.
Yeah, apparently the last bigger earthquake on the East Coast was in 1886. It was magnitude 7.3.
Wow, that must have knocked some things down.
Killed 60 people in Charleston, South Carolina. And then the next big one before that was 1755. So, yeah, this is about every 100 years we get a quake this size on the East Coast.
We're not built to withstand sizable earthquakes.
Well, we don't have the earthquake construction regulations that exist on the West Coast, but our construction's pretty darn good just at baseline. I mean, it's not like in Haiti, where this earthquake would have been devastating there because structures are not nearly as solid.
In pseudoscience news, Ken Ring, who says he can predict earthquakes based upon the moon and the weather.
I thought the last earthquake in New Zealand swallowed him up, unfortunately.
No word on the earthquake. Mm. His total last tweet was
silence.
August 19th, where he said, last week in September is the next largest danger earthquake risk. New moon very close to Earth and planet alignments. This is not astrology. Does he sound like he's on the defensive these days?
Yeah.
Because that sounds a little, like a little on edge.
This is not astrology.
Mm-hmm. So long as you say it, it's got to be true.
Whatever helps you get up in the morning. There was a recent study published looking at something I find very interesting, a psychological study, looking at people's brand loyalty. And what's interesting here that they found is that people will actually like really identify with a brand that are you a Mac or are you a PC thing? In fact, the advertising for PCs and Macs have actually started to deliberately try to exploit this to like really try to foster this you know, going beyond just liking a brand to really identifying with it. And what the researchers found is that when people identify with a brand, they start to invoke the same defense mechanisms that they would use in defense of that brand that they would in defense of themselves, right? So if somebody criticizes the brand, they sort of use the same defense mechanisms, the same psychological defense mechanisms that they would invoke if they were personally being attacked.
Explains a lot of stupid, pointless online arguments.
Yeah.
90% of them.
Right, right. So it becomes part of our self-image, and you know, what psychologists have, you know, this has been long established that, that we have egos, right? And when anything is threatens our self-image or our ego, that causes cognitive dissonance, and then we resolve that by rationalizing, by making whatever up whatever we have to in order to defend our self-image. So we're very kind to ourselves in terms of explaining our own behavior and whatnot in order to protect that self-image. And it's interesting that people will do the same things to things like, you know, a brand of product that they use. Clearly people do this also with like sports teams, right? That makes, I think that's makes more sense. And I think we sort of more intuitively grasp that, you know, you really invest emotionally in this, in the success or failure. Like it's, if your team wins, it's your personal success. And if they lose, it's your personal failure.
New England Patriots, right, Steve?
Oh yeah, man. They're awesome. So absolutely.
Even when they're not.
Then it's not their fault. But however, the difference is that there are limits to how much you will defend a brand, right? For yourself, you can't like distance yourself from yourself, if that makes sense. But if, like for example, people who are really loyal Mac users find out that that Apple has a bad record in terms of, you know, bad working conditions, if it sort of pushes somebody beyond sort of the limits of their ability to defend it, then they sort of flip. And they say, all right, I was betrayed by this brand.
Hmm.
So yeah, like they're protecting their self-image by protecting the brand they identify with. But then if it gets, if the brand is criticized to, in a way that they can't defend, they flip and then they protect their self-image by saying, all right, that the brand betrayed me. So it's not my fault either that I was deceived, you know, by the this evil company or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's a good microcosm of how we dig our heels in with something that we relate to or have a connection
yeah.
with. You do it instinctively. You know, I find that I'm constantly catching myself defaulting to that stance, and I have to stop myself. And I've found that I do it, and I can't stop myself until I've had some time to like really think about it.
Right.
I'd be interested to see what the mindset is of people in cultures that are less consumerist than ours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because mm-hmm. we get blasted with so many messages every day telling us that the brands we choose actually do make up a part of who we are. So people will purchase something specifically because they think that it is filling a specific part of their personality that is important to them. But that's just very specific to our culture. And there are plenty of places where I think that doesn't happen. So it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, how cross-cultural it is.
There.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any brands that you feel related to?
I am the Apple user, so I do tend to lean towards Apple. But that said, you know, when they screw up, I try to be, okay with criticizing them just as harshly as I would any other company.
So say something bad about Apple right now for me, just as an example.
I know that their price is high for a lot of people, and oftentimes the things that they create are not necessarily the right choice for a lot of people. They're the, you know, I feel that they're the right choice for me, but they're not necessarily the right choice for other people. And I think that's the thing I really hate about the online Mac versus PC fights. Like that happen whenever I tweet something about having a Mac or something. I get just a ton of idiots like, now I'm sure you're all lovely people, but you sound like idiots when, when you say, you know, oh, that's what you get for having a Mac.
We gave you grief for having a Mac. You know?
Yeah. And you sound like an idiot when you do that. You know, and I would never say to somebody who had a PC in seriousness, like, oh, well, that's what you get for having a PC if it breaks down.
Yeah.
Like, no, yeah. I'm sure you chose the correct machine for your needs. Yeah. You know?
But the deeper lesson here that we're all sort of dancing around is that, and for skeptics in general, is that the human psychological default mode tendency is to identify in a very tribal way, you know, with a group, with a political party, even with a brand, with a location, or whatever things that we tie up our self-identity with. And then we do, as Jay said, we dig in our heels, we defend it at all costs, we get the cognitive bias really kicks in, and we're very good at rationalizing flaws and whatnot in order to defend that self-image, which, you know, again, extends far beyond us literally, personally, to everything that we associate with.
Some would argue that our skepticism is exactly that.
It is. I think that skepticism and critical thinking and being sciencey and nerdy, I think those are they're the same things. They absolutely are. We're no different. We're people. We have the same cognitive biases and emotional needs. So I don't think that, you know, when this comes up, these kind of things, I think the way to transcend this is two things. One is to be aware of them, aware of the tendency to identify with things like political parties or whatever, anything we use to identify ourselves, to the point where we allow it to completely control our thinking. At least make the effort, as Jay said, you know, you got to make a conscious effort sometimes to step outside of that. And second is that when you're still going to have some kind of self-identity. I mean, you can't completely cut yourself off from any kind of identity. At least try to channel it in a positive way. And I think that the way I justify this could just be me rationalizing what I identify with, which is skepticism. But at least with critical thinking, you're identifying with a process, not some kind of end conclusion, right? I know we've mentioned that before. The process is rational and flexible and subject to change as new data comes in, et cetera, rather than any given conclusion where you're locked in regardless of what the evidence shows, right?
Yeah, if anything, we've said this before, but I actually find it interesting when we realize or find out that something that we believed has changed, or the scientific community, you know, finds out something new, and you're like, wow, that's different now, or oh my god, I can't believe it, and I don't feel the pain of the old thing going away. I'm actually like kind of interested in the new thing, and you know, it's exciting to have something updated.
And why did they think erroneously in the first place? And let's not make that mistake again.
Yeah.
That, all that said though, you know, advertising, I think, can be incredibly insidious in the way that it kind of infiltrates our day-to-day thinking. And so plenty of skeptics, like, you know, you, me, all of us are influenced nonstop by the messages that were being sent by corporations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've mentioned this before, but I'll say it again, like if you have kids, I think one of the greatest things you can do is teach them to be skeptical of the advertising that they're seeing.
Yeah.
And, you know, even as a skeptic, you know, I've been susceptible to it. I was making my living as a copywriter because I went to school for, you know, advertising and stuff. And when I was working for a fashion company, I found that I was, you know, buying more and more clothes, not from the brand that I was writing for, but for, you know, anything, just because, like, oh, well, I'm writing all about how these boots are in fashion this fall, and I've got to have these boots. I can't help it. I've been writing about them nonstop.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody's susceptible all the time, and being skeptical doesn't, unfortunately, it's not going to be a sort of vaccine against these messages that are reaching you and affecting you. It's just constant vigilance, I think.
Yeah, but it does help. I mean, it definitely is a good tool to yeah, I see it as, so like you're either going by day to day in almost like subconsciously, just going with the flow of whatever your subconscious brain is telling you, you think and feel, or you could try to engage your metacognition. You can step outside of that and try to actually think about the process of why you feel the way you do and why you think the way you do. And that is a fundamentally different approach. And it is very empowering. I think that's a lot of the core of skepticism, is that metacognition, is trying to step out of, you know, why we think and feel the way we do. And this kind of information about the need to protect our ego and how we can extend it to beyond ourselves, to teams and brands and political parties, whatever, is, I think, very, very useful to have. But it doesn't turn off your emotions. It just gives you a way of putting something else in the loop that is self-reflective, that can help you take a more healthy approach to it all.
So, guys, before we switch topics, though, I am curious to hear if there are brands that you identify with.
I have a physical addiction to a brand because it's Diet Coke. Not just it, there's the caffeine. It's my primary caffeine delivery system. But also, it's what I grew up on, and it's the first cola I just choose, I would reach for if given choices.
I mean, I notice, like, when I go shopping, there are certain brands that give me the warm fuzzies, probably because I remember them from my childhood. Like, if I'm buying pasta, I have to buy Ronzoni. Is it different than any other brand that's out? I have no idea. But
not significantly, no.
I doubt that it is. I probably couldn't tell the difference, if I was eating a dish of pasta between any of the 10 brands that are out there. But there's just I definitely buy Ronzoni because that's what I grew up with, and there's a comfort almost level to it.
Nice blue box too.
Yeah.
Packaging.
So, Steve, you're gonna actually like say Ronzoni is your brand that you relate to?
Well, I'm just saying. I'm trying to think, like, when I go shopping.
Typical Italian.
When do I care and when do I not care about the brand? I've noticed that I'm really locked into that brand, and I also realize that there's absolutely no reason for it whatsoever.
For me, I feel similarly, Steve. With this, for me, it's with Ferraris.
Right.
Just love them.
You bought one every time you bought a car.
Every time I can afford one, I buy one, and it's just warm fuzzy whenever I walk by one. Got to have it.
I have to admit, I kind of like when I identify with a brand. I'm not afraid to allow myself to enjoy like that aura that they make. I love Google. I love Google. I think the marketing that Google does, I don't know how it works, but I don't really see them doing any marketing. But for some reason, I have this perception that they're like mad scientists in the lab, and they're just kicking ass, everything that they do is good. And I just love how they're almost kind of like a secret society in a way.
but that reinforces what we were talking about, that marketers don't market products. They market feelings and lifestyles and images. The brand, these are the qualities of the brand. This is why you want it. This is what you feel like when you use it. And this is the image you have of yourself using it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I also love Pixar. I think Pixar.
Yeah, well, they're just awesome. Too, Jay. Yeah, they're just like infallible. Come on, look at their run. No, come on, look at their run.
But how would you feel if you found out that in the Pixar studios they're filled with like all dwarves chained to their desk?
Whatever works.
Just whistle. Or
I'm thinking, or like Oompa Loompas or something.
Oh my god!
Well, what
slave labor?
Willy Wonka saved the Oompa Loompas.
Yeah, exactly.
And then forced them into slave labor.
Okay.
It was for their own good. They couldn't have survived.
It was for their own good.
And then you'd be so happy, though. Why were they singing so
much? Okay,
what?
I identify with Willy Wonka there, I think.
Yeah, but he's not a brand. It's not a brand.
Yes, he is.
Yes, he
Actually,
is.
Actually, it is.
Oh, my God.
Willy Wonka is a brand?
Yes.
Yeah.
Jay.
Make candies, Jay.
After I saw the Willy Wonka remake a few years ago, after I left that movie, I had the biggest craving for a big Willy Wonka chocolate bar ever, and I went out and bought one. It was awesome.
Bob said big Willy.
All right, so they sell candy. Okay, you got me.
Evan, let me ask you a question.
Yes, Steve.
Who's that noisy?
Who's that noisy? That's my favorite question every week. You know that, Steve.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to play last week's Who's That Noisy right now.
That's too easy.
Go ahead, Bob. Tell us.
It's not Space Invaders?
No, not Space Invaders. Good guess. Thanks for playing.
It is some game.
It's a video game from the same era, though. It's Archon, right?
Yeah, it is Archon. Yes.
Yeah.
a Commodore 64 game. And it was actually the first Commodore 64 game I ever played, or kind of got a little addicted to. But in any case, back in 1983.
Commodore 64 was my first system.
And a fine system it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, mine was an Apple IIe.
I loved that thing.
That was your first, huh? The Apple
IIe. You're still loyal to the Commodore, sorry?
That's another thing. Like, all those old gaming companies like Atari and Commodore, like, they're awesome for T-shirts and stuff now, because it's like a company I used to be really loyal to and like, you know, just in love with when I was a kid.
Mm. Yeah, Atari was it. I mean, they were the first video game company. Like, you really, like, oh, Atari, they're awesome. Yeah.
Here was the funniest answer given by Trinnock. Was that the tuning up session before a Kraftwerk concert?
That's very good. Oh man,
that was my favorite answer.
But who won?
Andrew from Calgary, Alberta. He answered correctly first. There were several people who guessed correctly, and Andrew from Calgary was the first. Congratulations.
Awesome. Congratulations!
Well done.
Good job.
And what do you got for this week?
Here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy?
No one has an explanation for it. The fact that it disappeared. Like it was some sort of evil oasis in the middle of the night. And that was the most supernatural, strange thing that I've ever in my life experienced.
It's all not right, folks. David Duchovny? It sounds so much like him.
No, I'm sorry, Rebecca. Not David Duchovny. Mm. You like David Duchovny?
I love David Duchovny.
You don't like Mr. Spoggle?
Who doesn't love David Duchovny? I have a brand loyalty to David Duchovny, despite his weird sex addiction stuff.
In any case, folks, go ahead, give it your best guess for Who's That Noisy. Good luck, everyone.
All right, we got a couple emails this week. The first one, actually, we're going to do our first Twitter question.
Yes.
You can follow The Skeptic's Guide on Twitter. We do read it, and it's actually a good way to send us a brief question.
So cutting edge.
This one comes from Christopher Short, appropriate name, who writes, "Got handed a credit card after a woman unwrapped it from tinfoil. Stops people from reading it," she said. Plausible or nosable?
Is nosable a word?
It is now.
I don't nosable.
It's catchy.
What do you think, Evan? You looked into this whole wrapping credit cards in tinfoil thing.
I had no idea people were doing that. Frankly, I wasn't quite sure, but now I do know for sure that there is embedded in our credit cards devices that transmit signals.
Well, not in all credit cards.
Not in all credit cards, but it's
the newer ones. Yeah.
The newer ones, and some stats I read, there are about 90% of them that are issued now.
Yeah.
Unless you specifically request cards that don't have the transmitters.
Yeah, the RFID.
Yeah, the RFID. Yeah. So that's what Christopher's talking about, something called radio frequency identification, or RFID, RFID for short. So it's a technology that uses radio waves to transmit data between an electronic tag, which is embedded in the card, and a reader for the purpose of identifying and tracking an object. And there are lots of uses for RFID, not just credit cards. They include, you know, security badges for opening locked doors. Healthcare facilities use them to track the logistics of patients and patients' physical locations within a building.
Yeah, but we don't need those stinking badges.
We don't need those badges. And they're in passports as a method of preventing counterfeiting.
And subway cards, too.
Subway cards. They're all over. I mean, there's tons and tons of practical uses for them. But credit cards do have these transmitters. It's supposed to save time for both the retailer and the consumer in the transaction of paying for your goods, right? And there are certain cost accounting benefits to that. You know, you think, what's the difference? Okay, I hand someone my credit card as opposed to swiping it in front of a reader. You know, what's the difference between 1 second and 5 seconds? Well, when you add up all that time over the billions of credit card transactions that take place over a year, it can add up, and companies are well aware of that, and that's why they're doing it.
Yeah, plus magnetic strips wear out after a while.
They do.
I wonder if the RFID life cycle longer than the magnetic strip?
Are we going with RFID? I always thought it was RFID.
Me too.
But RFID has fewer syllables.
I'm not saying that it doesn't make sense. I'm just questioning whether or not that's common usage.
It is now.
It is. It's totally noseable.
It's noseable, yeah. Okay.
But the practice of capturing unauthorized transmissions from our RFIDs off of credit cards is called skimming.
See, it's catching on.
So does skimming happen? Yeah, it actually does happen and can happen, but it has some limitations. The strength of the transmission of these ARFIDs in the credit cards can vary. It's typically measured in inches. You know, it's not something that radiates out amongst the entire store and you can just, you know, pick it up anywhere. You have to be in pretty close proximity to the reader itself in order for the two mechanisms to activate.
Now, Evan, I've read here on Popular Mechanics that there aren't any documented cases of skimming credit card information through RFID outside of a laboratory.
Outside of a laboratory, right, Steve. There are no documented scientific cases of it. There are plenty of people online who have claimed that they've done it, that they've just bought these readers from wherever, you know, off the store shelves, basically. Which you can
build one out of like a cheap thumb drive.
You can build your own, and then they go around and they perform their own tests, unscientific though they are.
Yeah.
But you're right, Steve. I read the Popular Mechanics article as well, and in lab conditions, you can with those resources. You can definitely grab the information. But what information are you exactly grabbing? I mean, it's encrypted information. Typically, these credit cards have 128-bit triple data encryption standard technology, which is pretty high encryption security. But that doesn't fail-safe it, right? There are still ways to take that information and decrypt it. So what's a person to do? How can you protect yourself from people who potentially are going out getting these readers and sneaking up to the back pockets and wallets and purses and utility belts of people and scanning these things? Yes, I threw in utility belt for you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Some people claim that if you take your credit card, you wrap it in tinfoil, that will block the transmission that occurs. Well, is that the truth or not? The answer is possibly. Yes, it is feasible or plausible, as Christopher asked. So the answer to his question is yes, it is plausible. But there are also varying factors that you need to consider. First of all, the actual tinfoil itself. Not all tinfoil is the same. Some is thicker than others. Some is porous versus non-porous. Obviously, porous tinfoil is more apt to allow those radio transmissions to occur. There are certain – if you knew the exact thickness and consistency of the tinfoil and you got a specific kind, then, yeah, you probably could create a good barrier or a decent enough barrier. Based on the amount of credit card fraud that happens over the course of a year, for example, if you take it in the larger picture of credit card fraud entirely, this is a very, very small thing to worry about. You got much bigger things to worry about credit cards than somebody.
Oh yeah, the absolute risk is pretty low. You're at much higher risk from, you know, handing your credit card to, you know, a waiter who's then going to swipe it in the back room before he brings it back to you and keep the information, you know, to himself. But Popular Mechanics claims that they tested it and the tinfoil works. But wouldn't it be great if the Mythbusters tested it? Well, I mean, interestingly, when I was, you know, looking into this too, you type in, you know, tinfoil and myth, and of course what comes up is the Mythbusters. But apparently there's a couple of articles which claim that the Mythbusters were stopped from doing a segment on RFID security. Although at the end of the same article, it says that the reasons were, you know, that they weren't really stopped from doing it by companies that use RFID technology, that it was more really complicated internal reasons that he didn't want to go into. But the bottom line is they won't be airing a segment on investigating these types of questions about RFID. So we got to make do with the Popular Mechanics or just test it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's too bad that they won't be doing it, because I think that this issue needs to be popularized to the point where people actually are worried about it. Not that it's a huge threat right now, but the fact that you can build a skimmer, you know, in your home really easily, I think that that's something that credit card companies and, for instance, governments that are putting out passports with RFID in it need to take very seriously. And it seems that it's going to be a sort of arms race where they'll come up with a bit of encryption and somebody will hack it. So, I mean, I don't know. To me, I worry that they're not trying hard enough.
Yeah. Now, what's
to
interesting?
Update the technology.
Do you guys have the Easy Pass? You know, like a the way of automatically paying for tolls. It's awesome. But right when we got our Easy Pass, there were these things you hook onto your windowsill, and they send out they pay for the toll with a little radio signal to the toll booth. But they send you these little like metallic pockets to put them in when you're not using them. Yep. So that people can't steal, you know, from your, they can't like electronically take money from your Easy Pass account and steal your money. So they clearly think the technology works, or they want you to think it.
Right.
Right.
And on the part of the credit card companies, it seems like there's not even anything close to being that level of at least making your customers aware that this might be a possible issue,
right,
you know, currently or in the future.
Look, I didn't even know till recently that my credit card had it. I mean, I knew it had something in there, but I didn't really look into it much before this.
I also found a site that teaches you how to make a wallet out of duct tape.
Tons of sites of those. Yes,
and a friend of mine has one of those,
and they show you how to incorporate a layer of tinfoil so that you get a tinfoil wallet that will automatically protect your credit cards.
Bob, do you know what a Faraday cage is?
Yeah.
Everybody knows what a Faraday cage is.
Come on, Evan.
Was that all there was to that?
Send Bob up for a little contribution to the piece.
Well, it's just a metal cage that's supposed to protect you from electrical current. I mean, isn't that pretty much the bottom line?
Yeah, it works because if you have a perfect sphere of a conducting material, the net electrical charge inside that sphere has to be zero. That's why things like Faraday cages work. Because it's essentially a cage of conducting material, so it keeps there from being any significant electrical charge inside of it. So Jay, you have another installment in Swindler's List?
Yeah, I do, Steve. This one is about something called functional medicine and about how people are abusing this. So first off, what is functional medicine? Well, basically, functional medicine is our very own form of Western alternative medicine. The basic concept of functional medicine is that the doctor or the healthcare provider, because you know most of the time I'm assuming here that people that are exercising functional medicine are not actual MDs.
Oh, some are.
Yeah, but the vast majority seems to be chiropractors and other naturopaths and people like that.
Yeah.
So functional medicine is the idea or the approach that people have symptoms, and those symptoms are caused by something that's happening in the body. And instead of treating illnesses with drugs, they help that person by introducing a change in diet and, you know, maybe supplements. And they also want to get to the root cause of the issue and solve the actual problem and just not, you know, pump the person full of drugs. And, you know, if you think about it, it does sound good, but the end result and the way that this comes out in the wash is that they're basically just telling people, you know, live a healthy lifestyle, exercise more, you know, take these vitamins, have a healthier diet, and that'll get rid of the root cause of your issues.
You know, that's what it is on the surface, but in reality, it's just another marketing brand of pseudoscience and medicine. At the end of the day, they're using all the same old pseudoscientific crap, but this is just another way to market it. It's not really its own philosophy of treatment or medicine. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I did some searching, of course, and I'm looking at the way that people are defining it that are practitioners or that are supporting the idea of functional medicine.
That's the marketing. It's a marketing strategy. It's nothing else.
Let's talk about this. Let me read a paragraph to you here, and you can get an idea of how the words that they use and how they're selling it. Functional medicine emphasizes a definable and teachable process of integrating multiple knowledge bases within a pragmatic intellectual matrix that focuses on functionality at many levels rather than a single treatment for a single diagnosis. Functional medicine uses the patient's story as a key tool for integrating diagnosis, signs and symptoms, and evidence of clinical imbalances into a comprehensive approach to improve both the patient's environmental inputs and his or her physiological function. It is a clinician's discipline, and it directly addresses the need to transform the practice of primary care.
Yeah, total crap. So that's a massive straw man and an unstated major premise, right? So the massive straw man is that scientific medicine doesn't treat the underlying cause. That's nonsense. You know, in fact, science-based medicine is the only medicine that actually can identify underlying causes, because we're reductionist, you know, which, you know, they're trying to turn that into a bad word, but it really, what that means is we understand underlying causes. And of course we treat them when we know what they are. The other thing is they're saying that they know something about underlying causes that the rest of that science-based medicine doesn't know anything about. And that's nonsense too. They're just making it up. But again, this is just another way to wrap the same old, you know, pseudoscience in medicine. It's just another version of CAM, of quote-unquote alternative medicine.
So as functional medicine has progressed and it's becoming more popular and more people are learning about it, it's starting to seep its way into the current naturopath community, and people are grabbing onto it and actually making quite a bit of money off of this way of, you know, basically repackaging the same old thing. So let me give you guys the scam. The scam is that someone without an MD creates the illusion that they're a specialist. They select a niche market that could virtually be any disease or disorder, doesn't matter what it is, and they market themselves as a specialist and end up treating their patients with changes to diet and lifestyle, like I said before. So the idea here is that they'll sell themselves as a functional practitioner or a doctor that is practicing functional medicine. They will create a specialty. Like, Steve, just name any complete, off the top of your head, just give me anything, that a disorder or a disease.
A disease?
Anything.
Multiple sclerosis.
Okay, so they're going to be a specialist in multiple sclerosis using functional medicine as the process in which they're going to give you their treatment. So what they do is, now let's say it's a chiropractor. They'll remove the word chiropractic from everything all the marketing material that they have, all their pamphlets, everything that goes along with their business, take it off of their website, rename their business, which is, you know, which happens quite often with companies like this. And then what they do is they start to pretend that they are a specialist in multiple sclerosis, and they will call their company the Multiple Sclerosis Foundation of X City or whatever. And then the people that work at this place, at this, you know, fake place that I'm coming up with right now, will treat the whoever the practitioner is. It could be, it doesn't necessarily have to be a chiropractor, of course. It could be anybody. It could be virtually anybody, a healthcare provider. They'll refer to that person as a doctor, or, you know, they will create the illusion that that is a real doctor with a real degree and everything by the way that they refer to them. I mean, it's very easy for someone to pretend to be a doctor without actually having to say, I am a doctor, or I have, you know, I have a specialty in multiple sclerosis. I'm a clinical physician. They just walk the walk and talk the talk, and that's all that matters. Then what they do is they start advertising in newspapers. They start holding free seminars where they're giving free consultations. And the next thing you know, they build up a huge catalog of people that need help, and they make them pay up front. This scam typically goes like this. They go to the seminar, they sell the people for about an hour, hour and a half, and then they start telling them, well, we have 10 slots coming up with our free diagnosis treatment, but if you want to get these slots, you have to basically sign up for 6 months of treatment with our facility. How much is the treatment? The treatment is $5,000. The treatment is $10,000. Well, if you don't have the money, we'll help you with funding right now. We have, you know, we have a bank that we have a relationship with that would be happy to, you could take out a health loan to help pay your medical bills. A lot of times they'll lie to the patients and say that they actually will be covered partially, if not completely, with insurance. The patients come, and then they do bill the insurance company, but the insurance company will turn it down, of course, and then they tell the people, well, your insurance was turned down for this, and they start billing them. They just get their names in the database so they can start billing them. One doctor in particular, this chiropractor in Denver, actually has been making instructional videos on teaching other doctors how to pull off this scam. And I'm calling it a scam because that's the way he's treating it when he is giving instruction on how to, you know, morph their businesses into this money-making empire, which he's built. And the guy does make an enormous amount of money. Now, he had a website up, which is no longer up because he is being investigated right now. But I went into the Wayback Machine, and this was his website. Discover how to attract more quote-unquote sick patients with real organic and visceral illnesses and help them like never before utilizing functional medicine. In spite of today's down economy and without expensive equipment, time-consuming marketing, or confrontational sales techniques, when it's all said and done, and all you take is a really close look at the chiropractic profession, you suddenly realize that in spite of all that has transpired over the last 50 years, little has changed. Now, this is a chiropractor saying to other chiropractors, nothing has changed in our industry in the past 50 years. But now there's a change. So he continues, sure, there's licensure now, and sure, there's insurance reimbursement. But if you really look close, you realize only the only things that matter are chiropractors have been relegated to back and neck musculoskeletal pain, and they have to fight every day to just keep it that way. However, for the first time, quite possibly since BJ Palmer initiated the first HIO adjustment, a true change in chiropractic appears upon us. And possibly the best part is for you. Most chiropractors will ignore this change, which leaves a virtually competition-free environment for a select few very smart chiropractors to enjoy. And what he's selling here is the thing I just described to you, the way of transforming their business into this quote-unquote specialty business where they bring in customers. So this particular guy actually uses terminology that you'd find in a hard sales position. Like, he calls it deal flow leads, and he calls patients closes, you know, close the deal, and basically get them into your billing system and then just keep billing them.
Yeah.
That's holistic medicine.
Wallace Sampson wrote a 5-part article on functional medicine on science-based medicine. So if you're interested more in reading about that in particular, just look that up on science-based medicine.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney.
Fake-a-rooney.
This week we do have a theme. The theme this week is news items we missed.
Oh,
so these
good.
I went back a little bit farther. These are not like right hot off the presses. These are like from last month. Let's see if you guys remember these or earlier in the month. All right, here we go. Item number 1. Planetary scientists have produced a computer model that suggests that the early Earth had 2 moons. Item number 2, scientists discover antibodies that may explain chronic symptoms that persist following Lyme disease. And item number 3, new research supports the claim that some bacteria can feed off arsenic instead of phosphorus. Jay, go first.
So the first one here, planetary scientists have produced a computer model that suggests that the early Earth had 2 moons. So they created this computer model of the early Earth, and they think that maybe I'm just speculating here that the orbit or the rotation of the Earth was somehow explained. The current rotation and orbit maybe was somehow explained by another moon in there. I could see that happening. I'm thinking about like if we had 2 moons, maybe one was really big and one was small, or even eventually they had to coalesce together, hit each other maybe, and they grouped together somehow, or maybe one was wiped out by an asteroid or something. But sure, it's possible. Scientists discover antibodies that may explain chronic symptoms that persist following Lyme disease. I thought that this is actually proven already. I've talked to people that have had Lyme disease, and they've taken treatment for it, and they said that they've had reoccurring symptoms, or they've had symptoms that last a long time past the treatment of the medicine to get rid of the disease. So that one I think is science. New research supports the claim that some bacteria can feed off arsenic instead of phosphorus. Well, bacteria and nanotechnology can do anything, so how can I say no to this one? Sure. Of course some crazy weird bacteria with like 5 heads can eat arsenic. Why not? So I believe in all of them. Oh, no.
You understand the nature of this game, right, Jay?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I got it, Steve. I'm picking one of these.
And therefore,
I'm going to say that the moon one is the fake.
The 2 moons?
Yes.
Okay. Rebecca?
Oh, man. All right. I don't know any of these. But the moon one weirds me out because where did the other moon go? How early is early Earth? I don't know. I mean, I have recently learned that moons can be super, super tiny. So maybe it was a tiny moon. Maybe it just crashed into Earth or something. Maybe it was just a bad moon. It didn't know how to moon correctly.
Bad moon rising.
And so it died. chronic symptoms that persist following Lyme disease. That is really, I'm very skeptical of that because I was under the impression that chronic Lyme disease is a myth. So, yeah, that's, okay. And then bacteria feeding off of arsenic instead of phosphorus. I don't know. Is that supposed to trigger something like that arsenic-based life fiasco? I don't know. I feel like maybe you picked that one to throw us off. So I'm going to go with the Lyme disease one just because I thought we were solidly, I thought the science was solidly in the camp of chronic Lyme disease being fake. So I'm saying that one's the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Okay, we two moons. Wow, nice. Now we have one moon, apparently. Sure, producing a computer model suggesting Earth had two moons. Look, I wouldn't be surprised if they came up with a computer model suggesting the Earth might have had as many as four moons, and at some point they perhaps coalesced into one big moon. We have a relatively big moon based on the size of our planet, not the biggest, but relatively big. So I think that's plausible.
What's the biggest moon?
Oh, we did this a couple weeks ago, didn't we? Do Phobos? No,
Phobos, not even close.
Dummy,
stupid.
Biggest.
Don't go saying things unless you look it up first, Evan. Yeah. Why do you even Celsius?
What'd you say, Bob? Yeah.
Titan?
No, not Titan. Titan's number two. They used to think Titan was number one until they realized that its apparent size is partly due to its atmosphere, and the actual size of the moon is smaller, and therefore it got moved down to the number two slot, number one being Ganymede.
G.
There we
yes.
go. I knew it.
Thank you.
But I think that the biggest moon
Jupiter's gay boy lover
relative to its planet is Charon to
Charon.
Pluto.
Yeah.
But it's a dwarf planet. Yeah, let me finish. But it's a dwarf
Dummy.
Planet.
Stupid.
I love
skeptics.
It when Bob actually gets mad about stuff like this.
Skeptics now you're wrong, sir.
Anyway, Evan, you were saying?
Anywho, Lyme disease. Yes, many of the things Rebecca just said were going through my head as well about chronic symptoms and Lyme disease, and there is no real chronic episodes of Lyme disease. I'll move on to the last one, which is the one I think I'm the most familiar with because I could have sworn we spoke about this, I guess not that long ago, in which there was talk about life forms that can feed off of arsenic. Were they extremophiles that were in the depths of a pond? It was a big to-do because people were equating this to the possibility that this is a way for looking for life forms on other planets and so forth. And
maybe it's that thing I mentioned earlier.
It's a signature of some kind, and there were people who took those analysis to task because they were not well controlled. So therefore, I'm left with the Lyme disease one, I think the same as Rebecca, so I'll say that one's fiction.
All right, Bob?
The two moon thing, I remember seeing a show that's much older than I'm sure the news item you
In Search Of?
Took this from. No, that went into detail about how the moon is formed, and they were talking about how it is certain scenarios produce two moons orbiting the Earth. But the overwhelming probability was that they would merge and produce our one moon. So my memory is telling me that, yeah, there was a likelihood that there were two moons. And then we've got the Lyme disease one. Yeah, I agree with Evan and Rebecca on this. Both of them actually hit two points that I kind of agree with, especially I'm having trouble with the antibody thing and the relation to the chronic symptoms. That's definitely...
Antibodies.
Is antibody out there?
And the third one, yeah, I think that's meant to throw us, I think. I mean, feeding off arsenic is one thing, but incorporating it into basic biology is something different. And that's where the controversy was. So that one seems plausible as well. So I will have to go with the Lyme disease one as well.
Okay. So you all agree that new research supports the claims that some bacteria can feed off arsenic instead of phosphorus is science. You all think that one's real. And that one is... the fiction.
Oh. Ah.
Whoa.
What?
Thank you.
Bastard.
Wow. Bob, was it just asleep. Last week that you said I can't sweep you guys anymore? Was that just 1 week ago?
Rude knuckleball. Nice.
I don't recall, Senator.
I don't think that happened.
It might have been 2 weeks ago.
There's no recorded evidence anywhere of that.
Anyway.
Brava, Steve.
Good job, Steve.
Oh, it's funny because it's humiliating to be a woman.
Yes, that's right. Bob consulted both of us at the same time.
Or caught on a toilet during an earthquake.
It's just a nice diss when you call your brother a girl, that's all.
Yeah, especially when there's a girl on the line.
Oh, wait for the 24-hour show.
Who's okay with
show.
Being a girl?
No, it's completely unrelated. I mean, getting someone's sex wrong is pretty egregious.
Keep digging, Bob.
This is not going to end well for you.
Come on, Pat.
All right. So this is referring to the arsenic-based life research and an attempt to replicate that research. But the opposite results are coming in that, in fact, is not supporting but contradicting the research claiming that there are bacteria that can feed off of arsenic instead of phosphorus. This is research being done by Rosie Redfield.
Yeah, Rosie. She's awesome, by the way.
Interestingly, she's doing open source research. She's sort of doing it on her blog, and you can sort of follow along in real time as she's doing the research. And she felt, like many other scientists, that the original research claiming that bacteria was feeding off of arsenic and incorporating it into the DNA in the place of phosphorus, that it was flawed. And her two main criticisms are, one, that they did not adequately control for phosphorus contaminants so that they couldn't be sure that the bacteria didn't have some phosphorus to feed on. And similarly, they couldn't be sure that the arsenic that they were then detecting in the DNA wasn't itself also a contaminant, that it was really arsenic incorporated into the DNA rather than just itself a contaminant. So she's replicating the research, and so far she is failing to do so. She's showing that when you control for those variables more tightly, you don't come up with the same results that the original researchers did. So she's not done yet. The research hasn't completed yet, but that's where things are heading.
Well, good for her. I'm glad she's doing that because she was one of the most outspoken critics at the time about the NASA news story way back when. She came out immediately and smashed him for it.
So, the other cool bit is this whole live science, open source science kind of thing online. It's cool.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
That's cool.
So let's go to number two. Scientists discover antibodies that may explain chronic symptoms that persist following Lyme disease. Everyone but Jay thought this one was the fiction, and this one, of course, is science.
Wow.
I think that you guys are confusing, and this was my intention, you're confusing symptoms that persist following Lyme disease or chronic Lyme symptoms with chronic Lyme disease, which implies a chronic infection with spirochetes. So, yes, the scientific consensus, despite the fact that there is a subgroup, a small group of practitioners and patients who think they have chronic infection with Lyme disease, with the Lyme spirochete, and they treat it with recurrent courses of antibiotics, the scientific community largely agrees that that's not the case. But there is this other subset of people who have had Lyme disease and who have persistent symptoms, fatigue, maybe some pains, maybe some depression or memory problems. There is still this question, is this its own disorder? Is this something that's actually some process that's going on that was triggered by the Lyme disease? Or do these people just have other things, depression or chronic fatigue syndrome or whatever, that may or may not be related to their infection? But definitely one of the hypotheses is that the Lyme infection triggers an autoimmune response, which then triggers a chronic, essentially, autoimmune disease. And that's plausible. There are post-infectious autoimmune diseases. Maybe this is one. So now this is research that's testing that hypothesis. And what they did is they looked at the antibodies to different epitopes, different parts of the Lyme spirochete, in people who have had Lyme disease but didn't have chronic symptoms versus people who had Lyme disease and did have chronic symptoms. And what they found in the patients who had chronic symptoms is that they had antibodies to more different epitopes, to more different types of proteins on the Lyme spirochete. And that implies either that their immune system behaves differently, or it could mean that they had a longer infection and that the spirochete mutated throughout the infection, producing more different epitopes, more different proteins, that the host therefore had to make more different types of antibodies too, and that could somehow correlate to triggering this chronic immune state that then causes the chronic symptoms of Lyme disease.
Sneaky.
This means that planetary scientists have produced a computer model that suggests that the early Earth had two moons is science. And yeah, this was, I think, the easy one here. You guys were pretty much all over it. This actually was spawned by observations of the moon, differences in the far side and the near side of the moon. There's actually differences in the crust. So two planetary scientists actually, oh my God, Asphaug.
What?
A-S-P-H-A-U-G. How would you pronounce that?
Asphaug.
Asphaug. Oh my gosh.
That's
awesome.
That's got meat leg beat.
And Jutzi. J-U-T-Z-I.
This is made up. This is a made up news story.
No, it's in Nature News. I'll give you the link. Said that, well, that could, the differences in the crust could be explained if something crashed into the far side of the moon, like another moon, and did it slow motion style. So what they made this computer model to test out this idea that when the Mars size planet hit the proto Earth and threw up the debris that caused the moon, it actually threw up the debris, coalesced into two moons, but that second moon had an unstable orbit and eventually it like slow motion crashed into the moon that remained, forming one bigger moon, and that slow motion crashing produced the changes in the crust that we're now seeing on the far side of the moon.
Well, why do you stress slow motion like that?
Well, it wasn't like a quick impact, like an asteroid smashing into the Earth. It was, they like merged over hours.
That's any big impact would be like that. I mean, that's just the nature of massive objects colliding.
Oh, check out the brain Bob.
But that's not true, Bob, because that's the difference between something coming in fast, like on a fast trajectory coming in like from the outer solar system and barreling into the inner solar system versus two moons that are in not quite the same orbit that have a very small relative speed to each other. There's a vast difference in the relative speeds, but that's what they're talking about.
It wasn't like a head-on collision. It was like one catching up to the other or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, in that sense, yeah. All right, I see what you mean. They were very nearly in the same orbit, same speed anyway. So, yeah, in that sense.
Their relative speed was slow as opposed to a high, like a bullet hitting a planet, like an asteroid. Yeah, exactly. So, it explains contemporary observations of the moon. It makes sense on a computer model. It fits with our model of how the moon was made. So it's not the same thing as proof that it actually was the case, but it seems like a plausible scenario. So, got all you guys, I wasn't even really trying to sweep you this week.
Shut up. Just shut up.
It's just
you weren't trying to sweep us.
Not even trying.
That's not the way to make it better.
Yeah. Well, actually.
I'm not trying to make it better.
That just means it was totally accidental and a fluke. So, yeah, I get it.
I wouldn't call it a fluke.
No, what that means is, Bob, is that he's so good.
Yeah, he doesn't even have to try.
I wasn't trying to make it especially hard so that I could sweep you. I just, it was just three interesting news items.
Whatever.
Good job, Steve.
Just wait till the 24th show. Oh, I'm going to get you.
That's when you get me. That's when I get revenge, huh?
It will be my first time serving up a science or fiction, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
And every time Steve gets one wrong, he gets a pie in the face.
Pie in the face?
Well, hang on. What kind of pie are we talking
about? Banana cream pie.
Yeah,
banana cream pie. All right. Or coconut cream. Either one.
How about shoe fly?
Yeah, coconut cream.
No, shoe fly. Have you ever had shoe fly pie?
That is gross. No,
what's in shoe fly pie?
What is it?
It's like eating a brick of molasses.
I thought it was a made up thing for fairy tales. What is shoe fly?
You'd have gotten that wrong in science or fiction.
It's sugar and molasses in like a brick.
What's wrong with that? That's brown sugar.
You wouldn't want it to hit you in the face, I think was the original point.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
You like The Simpsons, Steve?
Of course.
Who do you like on The Simpsons?
Other than Homer, who was like, has to be your favorite.
Yeah.
What? No.
Come on, Homer's awesome.
Homer rocks.
Name a character you like on The Simpsons.
Mr. Burns.
I like Mr. Burns, yeah. He's good.
I name another character.
The best character on The Simpsons.
Apu Nahapa.
Name someone else. Go ahead, name another character.
Just please name
Lisa, Flanders. Bart,
Ned
Marge.
All right, Ned Flanders. Okay. Of course you like Ned Flanders. He's great. Ned Flanders, right? Okay, so he said, science is like a blabbermouth who ruins the movie by telling you how it ends. Well, I say there are some things we don't want to know. Important things. Ned Flanders.
Very good.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
It's nice being joined
too.
Let me go.
It was a pleasure sweeping you. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.